Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by...
This podcast is supported by Cartier. In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, Cartier shares testaments of love in all its forms from around the world. Please keep listening for today's love story later in this episode.
This is A.O. Scott. I'm a critic at the New York Times. What I do and what the other critics here do is part of the same project that all of the journalists at the New York Times work on every day to give you clarity and perspective and, above all, a deeper understanding of the world. When you subscribe to the New York Times, it's not just here are the headlines, but here's the way everything fits together. If you'd like to subscribe, please go to nytimes.com/subscribe.
Produced by the iLab at WBUR, Boston.
A note before we start. This episode deals with suicide, and it may not be right for all listeners. From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. Whether we think about it or not, most of us create a digital imprint as we move through the world. Instagram posts, tweets, Facebook status updates, and TikToks can all seem inconsequential when we post them, but they do become a record we leave behind. Kylie Letty writes about that in her essay, Years Ago, My Sister Vanished. I see her whenever I want. Her piece is read by Daisy Edgar Jones. Daisy stars in Normal People, which premieres on Hulu on April 29th.
Don't worry, reads the cover photo of my sister's Facebook page. Everything is going to be amazing. The words, in neon blue, green, and red, glow from the screen as a kind of preternatural promise. A message from beyond. When I'm feeling stressed, I click on her profile, gaze at that image, and take a deep breath. People leave notes, messages, and pictures on her page. They say, I miss you, I love you, and I'm thinking about you. They can't leave flowers, but they do leave animated hearts. Sometimes they even travel through time by responding to a comment of hers from years before, and a certain magic is created. The conversation extending across a bridge of years, transcending her absence. The page facilitates a continuation, an afterlife. On Facebook, my sister's words are preserved, frozen like a photograph. And her photographs remain too, marking the stages of her young life. You can view them chronologically, scrolling to see a giggling girl in a pink Patagonia fleece become an 18-year-old model with a disposable camera and a goofy smile. You can watch her tan legs grow long, her hair become blonder and curled, her freckles scatter into constellations across her nose. You can see the seed of rebellion sprouting into an idea, her green eyes alive and wild. Every so often, I click on the videos tab and watch as she and a friend drive through a toll gate with incorrect change. I listen, again and again, as my sister laughs. The video is grainy and absurd, and it's difficult to distinguish faces, but her laugh is distinct, ringing out my favourite sound, throaty and extravagant. I used to call my sister's phone when she first disappeared. I knew she wouldn't answer. The signal had vanished the moment she had, but the voicemail was intact. When I needed to hear her voice, I would dial her number and she would tell me to leave a message. Occasionally I did. I would tell her about my day or ask where she was. Other times I would cry, my silence following the beep. I used to text her number too. Technology allowed me to continue that casual correspondence like a widower might speak to a gravestone, I kept her up with the Kardashians, told her what colleges I'd applied to, related gossip from our high school and the details of our parents' separation. I told her crazy things, ridiculous things, things you only tell your older sister. The messages were automatic, reflexive, a mode of self-comfort. Until one night, while out with friends at an Irish pub in Boston, I received a reply. At that point, it had been 2 years since the frigid January night, when she took a taxi to the foot of Philadelphia's Benjamin Franklin Bridge. 2 years since my parents sat with detectives, viewing security camera photos that showed her walking towards the bridge's high point in her red North Face jacket, but not continuing. 2 years since the searches for any trace of her came up empty. My family never officially proclaimed her deceased, but the reality settled in our stomachs like the dust that fell upon her untouched bedroom. When my iPhone buzzed at the bar in Boston and her name appeared on the black screen, I was so startled that I dropped it, my hands instantly slick and my heart racing. I was a freshman in college then and hadn't told my new friends about my sister. It was easier to say I was an only child than to reveal the complicated truth. At the pub that night, a band was playing my sister's favourite song, so I had texted, "I miss you." That's when her name appeared, with the message, "Who is this?" I rushed to the bathroom and made it into a stall where I collapsed onto a toilet seat, thinking, "She's alive! She's alive!" Shaking, I pressed the call button. "Hello?" a voice said. It was a female voice, but deeper than my sister's. Older. The woman explained that she had been given the number with her new cell plan. My roommates found me sobbing in the stall, mourning a new kind of loss. They guided me out past a well-meaning stranger at the sink who said, "Whoever he is, he's not worth the tears, trust me." I wanted to say, "He is a she, and trust me, she's worth it." I told my friends the truth that night, though it's a truth I've struggled to face myself. After all, if I could still see her, hear her, and text her, was she really gone? If Facebook reminded me annually of her birthday and calculated the passing years into her current age, then her death wasn't a period or an end, but more of an ellipsis. And I could still imagine the dot 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 of a chat bubble popping up at any moment. When someone you love disappears, there's no finality of an autopsy report or the closure of a funeral. All you have is a lack of presence. You can piece together the mystery like in the Nancy Drew books you used to devour, but there's no memorial service to confirm the truth. And that's the problem. The promise of possibility, however faint, is harsher than any certainty. It has now been 5 years since her disappearance, and I still fantasize about an alternate outcome. That senseless hope is hard to smother. The off chance that someday I may see her face in a crowd, as familiar as my own reflection. I'll run towards her and save her this time. I have this dream a lot, intruding on other dreams, bullying them, demanding to be heard. Several years ago, my mother suggested we delete my sister's Facebook account, wondering if it was inappropriate, the way her online life is paused with her random thoughts and photos on public display. Ultimately, we decided not to. It brings me too much comfort. As the years pass, I'm now the age she was when she disappeared. I've come to know her better from the quotes she posted in her bio, the songs she cued in her iPod, the comments she left on her friends' photos. It's like getting to know someone through glimpses in a window, but it's better than nothing. And yet, I understand my mother's view. There's something indecent about holding on to social media. It's so alive, so casual, so improper. There are screenshots of FaceTime conversations, selfies, profane jokes, a picture of her asleep with a friend's chihuahua. Recently, I read about the development of chatbots that can imitate human speech patterns. The technology is being considered as a way to facilitate bereavement, allowing us to communicate with loved ones through text messages. Using personal data and old messages, the bots can respond like your father, grandmother, or sister. They can use your loved one's favourite phrases and dialectic habits. They can say, "I miss you too." With such sophisticated technology, the question is no longer what's possible, but what's morally permissible. In the grey area between preservation and personality theft, there is a danger of too much holding on and not enough letting go. Memorials never feel like enough to the grief-stricken, never big enough or grand enough to commemorate the people we lose. Technology may get us closer, replicating faces and voices with alarming accuracy, but it will inevitably fall short. These days, there are fewer friends posting on my sister's page, not as many hearts. As Instagram surges and Facebook recedes, I wonder how long her page will remain active. It's sad to think that interest in my sister may depend on the relative popularity of a social media platform. For now, the photos keep her memory vivid, and I like the solidarity of knowing when others think of her and how they express that love. With absence comes forgetting, and Facebook helps me remember what I cannot bear to lose. On her page, her essence remains. The way she extends her words with too many vowels, "I miss you," becoming "I miss you." The bright colours of her crochet top, the fuchsia she painted her nails one summer, a picture of us on Cape Cod, my gangly knees resting on her tan shoulders at sunset. I can see the scar on her lower lip from when she fell out of her bedroom window, sneaking out to a high school party. I can see her nose scrunched up as she readies herself to tell a joke. Facebook cannot mimic my sister's flowery handwriting, remind me how she smelled when wearing her favourite perfume, or hug me the way she used to. But it can preserve the post she left on my wall 6 years ago that reads, "I love you." Sometimes, that's enough.
That's Daisy Edgar-Jones reading Kylie Liddy's essay, "Years Ago My Sister Vanished, I See Her Whenever I Want." We'll catch up with Kylie after the break. Kylie Liddy won the Modern Love College Essay Contest in 2019. She says that before her piece was published, she and her family had to wrestle with what it would be like to have the story of her sister's suicide out in the world.
There's this aspect of my sister that I didn't want to really get into in the essay. She was going through a lot at the time. She was struggling with mental illness, and a lot of that was kind of degrading the things that made her who she was. And I was afraid to kind of bring that subject into the world in this essay because it was my first time really writing anything for the public. And pretty much a year has passed now since the essay came out. I've realized that it's not enough just to talk about the good and that it's okay to say that there are really hard times, that sometimes my sister wasn't who she wanted to be. I think the best thing we can do is kind of be honest about both aspects, the good and the funny times and the ways I want to remember her, and also that she struggled.
Kylie says that before the essay was published, she tried to make her sister's Facebook page less public.
My sister is a couple years older than me, and she kind of was using Facebook in a different way than I think that we use it now, maybe even. Like, it was way more casual for her, and not something that she was maybe wanting to be put on the New York Times page. So for me, it was trying to protect her in a certain way in her memory. But I was emailing customer service like nonstop before the essay came out, asking them if they could make a memorialized account. And just because I didn't have that death certificate, even though we are certain what happened, it wasn't possible to make it into this new state.
Kylie eventually came to terms with the fact that her sister's Facebook page is relatively accessible. She still visits the page, and she still takes comfort from it.
There's this risk when someone passes away that we're going to lose the certain aspects of them that made them who they are in these little ways. The way they smiled or just strange small details. Now I feel like I look back at my sister's Facebook page less as this need to remember her and more as this like comfort that it's there and I need it and that she's always going to be there with me in different ways now too.
Kylie graduated from college last year. Now she's working in journalism in New York City, although she's back home in Massachusetts during the quarantine. And she recently got a book deal. She's working on a book about her sister and thinking about her a lot.
It's kind of funny. I have these old text messages that I've saved from my sister, and a lot of them are like really lovely, and they'd be after we had a fight. So it's kind of ironic, but we'd have a fight, and she would message me something so kind, and sometimes I wouldn't even answer because I would be mad at her, and now I regret that, obviously. But in a few of the text messages she sent to me, she says that she loves me and all these amazing things, and then she says she hopes that I write one day, and I try to hold on to knowing that she wanted this for me. And now that my kind of my big break in writing was this essay about her and now this book about her, it makes me feel like we are doing it together in a strange way, and that that this aspect of sisterhood and like wanting the best for each other and supporting each other is still there.
That's Kylie Leddy. She's a writer and works as an editorial assistant at Parents Magazine. She's working on a memoir. And many thanks to Kylie for recording herself at home. More after the break. Daniel Jones is the editor of the Modern Love column for the New York Times. He says that most people who submit to the Modern Love College Essay Contest write about romantic love. Kylie's essay stood out.
So her essay was really an unusual perspective to have a sister relationship, but it was so powerful. And we felt the essay was such a brave sort of investigation into her own emotions about having someone so close to her disappear without confirmation of what had happened to her for so long. And just the way she was able to, at a young age, capture how that feels and how it continues to tug at you and how you move on, ultimately.
And here's Daisy Edgar Jones.
I find the kind of topic of the way we deal with grief and social media very, very interesting because on the one hand, I think it's a really wonderful thing that it can be something we share to speak about it and to see the way other people deal with it. And there is such a comfort, as said in this essay, of, you know, being able to remember someone and commemorate them in any kind of form. But on the other hand, I completely relate to what she talks about of the kind of strangeness of keeping this part of someone going when they are no longer with us and whether that's morally wrong. So I just found the essay fascinating and very beautiful and very sad. So that's why I chose the essay personally.
Thanks to Daisy for reading Kylie's piece. Daisy's new show is Normal People. It premieres on Hulu on April 29th. And Daisy was our latest actor to record herself, so thank you to her for asking her roommates to turn off the TV, waiting for the guitar player next door to stop playing, and pausing every time a truck went by. Daisy did a terrific job. Modern Love is a production of the New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Caitlin O'Keefe. Original scoring and sound design by Matt Reed. Iris Adler is our executive producer. We're edited by Catherine Brewer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for the New York Times and advisor to the show. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Additional thanks to Mia Lee, Julia Simon, and Anya Stremian at the New York Times, and to Michael Garth at WBUR. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. See you next week.